welcome, Johnny.
Thank you.
Could you just tell us a little bit about you and your company?
Sure, okay. So I'm Johnny. I run ORB International in the UK. And we've been the Gallup International member for maybe 7 or 8 years. But my father was like on the board and a member. He used to run Gallup in the UK. So I guess growing up as a kid, I'd always heard and was familiar with Gallup, 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 Gallup. My mum used to say, I'm married to Gallup.
Yeah, okay.
Rather than to her, Gordon was the name of my dad. But yeah. So that's where we are. So and really, the business has been was established in the UK in 1994 because the American Gallup Inc. bought Gallup in the UK. My dad opposed it, but the other three directors bought it. They owned 60%. He owned 40%. So he I guess was forced out and set up RB in 94, and it was doing sort of domestic UK work. And it was doing okay. It was doing well. Took some clients from Gallup, which I think they enjoyed. And then for us, probably the game changer. There were two game changers. There was one in 2004. I ended up working for the Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. I pitched for the, who were in opposition at the time. And I guess that introduced me to a lot of quite high level people. And it was the first election campaign. I was the private pollster, so it was the first election campaign I'd ever been involved in. Right in the kind of like heart of it, briefing the leader and stuff like that. And then the other game changer sounds corny, but I met a man from Iraq.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Right. I met a man from Iraq at a university in London.
Yeah.
And I got on well with him. And then a bid. So this was, so then obviously like Iraq was invaded in 2003. And whenever you get an invasion, you often fairly soon after start thinking about the information environment. Yeah. And if you're thinking about the, because you're trying to send messages into whoever your target audience is. Yeah. And if you're thinking about the information environment, then of course you need to think about research.
Yeah.
Because you need to assess, evaluate, the impact of your campaigns. So the UK Ministry of Defence, which kind of had control of the southern bit of Iraq, really, put out a tender to poll and run focus groups in Iraq, which me and Dr. Monkith, now the Gallup International member for Iraq, won.
Yeah.
And then, I guess because of the sad conflict, the cycle of conflict in Iraq, I think bar 2012... we've done it every single year and monthly.
Wow.
or every other month since then. And then that's led to other... That opened your eyes, my eyes, to another customer in the defence space. And off the back of that, we have basically pivoted very much towards fragile conflict zones.
Yeah, which introduces a bunch of challenges as well.
How do you absolutely. Find the people? Say for example, like Sudan now.
Yeah.
Right. So 2.5 weeks ago, whenever it kicked off, we start receiving signal messages from the customer who basically wants to know what's going on the ground.
Yeah.
And the good thing about research and face-to-face research, obviously, is that if you're going to do that properly, you need to have a network.
Yeah.
Right? So you need to have supervisors, ideally in each of your regions or your governorates or whatever it happens to be. And then they're normally connected to, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 10 interviewers in each of those regions.
Yeah.
So if the conflict is happening in Khartoum or Port Sudan or Darfur, whatever, as long as there's an agency there... And it helped that we'd happened to have been working with them recently. Then we just call up the network and we just supply. I mean, some people would call it intelligence,
yeah,
insights,
yeah,
But it's nothing's classified because we're collecting observations and people's opinions.
So
there are challenges with it in that. I mean, there are very real challenges in that interviewers have been often arrested, put into jail. In Iraq, we had a terrible incident where three were murdered. Happened in South America as well. Two were murdered. Now, whether that was completely random, the three in Iraq were picked up in a place called Sadr City in Baghdad, which is known to be volatile. Whether they were targeted, we couldn't find anything to suggest they were. Our customer couldn't find anything to suggest they were. So we don't think they were. But, yeah, that's a danger that's...
Yeah.
And obviously, like, you know, there are some countries where you have to get permission. Yeah. So you have to submit the questionnaire for permission. You know, and there are some people who kind of think, you know, I'll skip that. I won't go for permission.
You'd
be fooled to do that. Because if it... There's a lot of police... Syria, you know, Syria has... Yeah. Assad has, is it 11 or 10? I can't remember. Different intelligence services running around everywhere. You know, they've got eyes and ears everywhere.
Yeah, and they could get suspicious of people asking questions to random
And we're not
people,
asking questions about washing powder or coke.
Yeah.
We're asking questions about, you know, politics and security and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more pointy. So you have to play by the rules where there are rules. In many countries there aren't.
Yeah.
You know, and you do a risk matrix beforehand. And, I mean, generally it's, touch wood, it's, the incidents are very few and far between, and normally they're resolvable.
Yeah, yeah.
In Afghanistan, the thing was always you'd have to go, I mean, we'd end up buying goats that were to be sacrificed for the villagers to let the interviewers out, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and you told me yesterday about flyers.
Leaflets. I mean, so for me, the you know, as you saw from the guy who did the social network analysis mapping. For me, the information space and the manipulation of the information space is fascinating. And if you look at the tactics, for example, if you look at the RSF in Khartoum over the last 2 weeks, they have deliberately attacked and overtaken many of the media channels.
Yeah.
I think, as I said to you yesterday, you know, ISIS in Raqqa came in and they started taking down mobile phone masts.
Yes.
They restricted the internet. You went to a cafe, you had an hour, and there were two guys observing what everyone was doing. So they restrict the information environment.
Yeah.
And then you get people manipulating the information environment. So for me, that's how that shapes opinion.
To me
is really interesting.
It is, and it's it doesn't have to be a conflict zone.
No,
but it gets more.
It could be an election. Very easily. In the Trump presidential election, you know, I guess at the time, were the Russians involved in the presidential election? One side yes, the other side said no.
Yeah.
I probably read a few articles and didn't really have a clear view either way. Yeah. I could believe it. But having seen now what I've seen, often without a doubt.
Yeah, yeah.
They were getting involved in it and in a big scale. So, you know, what impact that had on vote, like what impact that had on vaccine take-up.
Yeah.
No, was it in Sweden you had 98? Did you say that? Or maybe it's another country said they had a very high take-up. But these are like real-life issues.
Exactly. And from a US perspective, I remember actually Obama, when he was leaving office, he had a press gathering for the press, but only talked to the press, not for the people, and saying about the Russian involvement in the election, and saying, well, it wasn't very sophisticated. Because what they did was hacking a database mm-hmm. and then distributing information about Hillary's emails.
Mm-hmm.
But every time they did that, media caught on the next second. I even had a seminar in Sweden with Swedish media manager about this. Could this happen in Sweden? I actually had a woman from US who had talked to Congress about this. But the thing is that it's like this red flag that, or like a laser pointer that media cannot stay away from. Breaking news, new emails.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's so easy. And that's the scary part about this. Because of course, because, yeah, the public, they need information.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and they want to gather information. And what happens when media is getting skewed, or I think every dictator, step one is to control the media.
Yeah,
basically.
I mean, absolutely. I remember the BBC at home now run a very good advert, actually, about trying to educate people about the processes they go through to validate their sources. But they'll also, like many other channels, are trying to help you to identify, you know, real news from fake news and stuff like that. But even if it's fake news, at the end of the day, it's a message.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And if someone is sticking out 100,000 of them, and we're only sticking out 5,000 of them, then a lot more people are going to be exposed to the fake message than the real message. So I think if you can... what we've never been able to do, which is to what we call quantify the echo chamber.
Yeah.
So if you could actually measure that, that would be very interesting.
Yeah. But I suspect it's very hard in a conflict zone, because then it's hard to... The best thing you can do there is face-to-face interviews, more qualitative research, getting... You cannot do like a population estimation of a good... In a good sense, I suspect that's very
you have
hard.
A lot of you have a lot of moving people, you know, displaced internally and beyond people. The leaflets and the obviously the way we communicate, you know, even over the last 10 years, 15 years, is improving and becoming more sophisticated all the time. But when the adversary tries to deny the media space, because rightly they know that the West is going to try to message into their area of interest, then literally throwing millions of leaflets out of the back of Hercules planes, which seemed like 2012, you think that's like something, you're doing World War One or something, two or something, but the media space was denied then.
And it really is fascinating. But it's also, two things I think about. Sure, even if you're only doing qualitative work, you cannot do a quantitative study there telling how many people think this and that. What I know you're doing at the same time is you're collecting you have a lot of experience of what will happen with these kinds of messages in this kind of situation, even though the situation isn't in Sudan, it could be in
it's different.
But from that you could interpret the actual effect to an extent.
You do what the military call what's the MOP, what's the MOE. So the MOP is the measure of performance, which is how many people, it's metrics off the back of Facebook, for example. It's how many people saw it, shared it, liked it, whatever. But then what's the measure of effect? Because obviously when you launch a campaign, your creative strategists will say, these are the three desired effects we're going for. Back us. Yeah. And if we do this, and this, then this should happen.
Yeah.
So there are lots of... surveys that are designed to measure performance and measure effect. So the good thing about research, and this is the point I was trying to make on Monday, is that I think it's amazing that our industry, we can basically do research whether that's market or opinion polling, in any country in the world.
Mm. Yeah.
I can't do opinion research in North Korea. I've tried.
Mm. Yeah.
But I can't do that, right?
Yeah.
But there are no other countries. Yeah, some are harder than others. Some are more expensive than others. But our industry can literally cover the globe.
Yeah.
And quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and get really good, valuable insights quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think our challenge as an industry is first talking about this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we get, I have a feeling that we lack the confidence as an industry in whole to actually trust our own knowledge and work. Although we're just doing it, but it feels, oh, maybe Facebook will do it tomorrow. But no.
No, I think you're right. I think obviously, you know, I mean, within the marketing industry, if you want to call it that, you know, I guess we're always.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Lower down.
Yeah.
The chain of command or whatever.
Yeah.
I do. I think we get too sidetracked in, you know, panel sizes and.
Yeah.
Yeah, with AI, they are important issues, but we get bogged down in the weeds sometimes.
Yeah.
And we don't, when I was a kid, I remember, you know, DHL, we can deliver any package anywhere in the world. And I was thinking, Jesus, like, I mean, amazing what they can take. I can give you a package and I can say, I want that to go to New Zealand tomorrow. What the hell happened? Like, it's like, that's all we do.
Yeah, yeah, it is. But we forget to own that position.
Absolutely.
And I think the other thing is that we forget to tell the story that every person is basically more or less the same. We have the same brains. We have the same emotions. Sure, we have cultural differences, but we have the same trigger points. We might have different context because of culture and religion, but we're still acting more or less the same to the same stimulus.
Yeah.
Which means the knowledge we have about human behavior is extremely powerful because we can quickly assess the situation and say, but this is, which I'm sure you're doing every day because your job is to give a view of that.
Yeah. I think when the conflict in the Ukraine started, clearly a lot of people were interested not only on opinions within the Ukraine, but clearly also opinions within Russia, basically to see, you know, how popular Mr. Putin was. And assessing that really quickly was interesting and also quite shocking.
Maybe,
you know, the fact that a country that many have been to, a country that, in their words, certainly Eastern Russia, Putin himself probably felt closer to Europe.
Yeah.
And the fact that really, again, also by controlling the media environment, he has such wide support.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the narrative, and it was interesting, is the narrative he's pushing there, I mean, it isn't just being pushed around Russia, you know, we were doing focus groups in Togo, in Africa, a couple of months ago, and people literally started talking about Nazism in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
That is nuts.
Yeah, it is. It is.
You know, that someone down there who is scratching around maybe for work, maybe for food, you know, electricity, whatever.
Yeah.
Heard of and was talking about Nazism in the Ukraine.
Yeah. Yeah, it is nuts. And actually, that scares me a lot because going back to the BBC, for instance, telling, because I see the same in most countries, telling people we should learn how to assess what is reliable news or not. But going into to today with artificial intelligence, you can basically do anything. The only thing you could trust now is the sender of the news.
Yeah.
It's a media house. But they have not really realized that. So BBC cannot do a mistake. And if they do, they really need to own that mistake. Yeah. Because then you can trust them.
Yeah.
Because no one is flawless, but the ones who can handle their mistakes in a good way. And that is a big challenge, what I see in most media houses now, because they never can own up to a mistake to the extent that the effect of a bad publication will come. And then going back to Russia, whose media has one core purpose, and that's support the government and Putin for, like, how long has it been? Forever, it feels like. So it's not in a vacuum he's pushing his agenda about the Ukrainian invasion. This comes for a very long time, giving same narrative. So he has a basis in this, which means, because he is never wrong in the public space in Russia.
No.
I know Gallup International did a poll like 2010. I'm trying to find that one because it's got lost in the archives. But I referred to it a couple of times because there we looked at the trust in democracy in different countries.
Mm-hmm.
The highest trust was in Russia. And in the US, people weren't too bad with having a military coup just to get things in order. And UK, the trust weren't that high either. But that is from the same narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because the media has never said anything bad about Putin in Russia, basically.
Because they can't.
Exactly, they can't. But in Sweden or UK or US, the leader, if you're in the news as a leader, there's something you've done wrong.
Yeah.
So the media is always like punishing the government. That's not the purpose, but they focus on the negative.
Oh, aspects. Yeah, without a doubt, yeah.
So they're undermining the trust in the government because the news is always the bad dimension. And I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, but the contrast to a non-open media makes it so much easier to push a bad narrative in a democracy.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, like 10, if you were watching the TV and the word breaking news flashed right? It was like a prime minister had died or a member of the royal family had, you know, died or something. It was once a year, once every 2 years event, breaking news.
Yeah.
Now, if you watch Sky News,
yeah,
it's like, ka-ching, breaking news, ka-ching, breaking news. I mean, it's just cheapened it.
Yeah.
It's this race to just inform people about everything all the time.
Yeah. In national television in Sweden last night, but on their app, the breaking news was that one dog has been hit by a car and the driver ran away. But the news underneath that was one guy getting shot.
Uh-huh.
But the top one was dog getting hit by a car. I said, this is public service in Sweden.
How is that credible?
You
know, people say that polling,
yeah,
like in elections, polling's been cheapened because, you know, again, 30, 40 years ago in the UK, they were basically, Gallup had the Tories.
Yeah.
Morrie had Labour.
Yeah.
Gallup had the Telegraph. Morrie had the Times.
Yeah.
The newspapers would be a monthly poll. You know, and the political party stuff would be internal, but then, you know, they might push some of that out. But it was done professionally, but it was done on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
Now, oh my God, you can't pick up a newspaper without reading the latest poll and voting intentions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And as an industry for us, it's quite difficult. It's been cheapened. Obviously, the drive to push everything online. It was interesting yesterday, Michael and Pascal talking about probability, online probability, sampling. Absolutely, you know, and that makes a lot of sense. But it costs more money.
Yeah, it does, but not compared to telephone interviews.
No, but in the UK, I mean, I couldn't tell you what the split is, but I guess 60-75%, I suspect, of research, fieldwork in the UK is carried out online.
Yeah. And UK has been one of my had examples of where it broke down completely, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think there it goes back to our role and not understanding what we're doing. Because looking at the message, I usually use bad research as an example for disinformation. Even if you want to push it only for your own PR purposes, everybody loves my brand, and you do some cheap poll just to get the numbers you get, you tend to fool yourself as well. So suddenly you do business decision based on your own propaganda, because you cheapen out on doing good research and understanding because it was just a PR. I see this every time, that you then get surprised that everybody didn't love your product. So you actually push the entire message of your own company internally as well to this propaganda. So it's a two-way thing that will hit you, and it will cost a lot of money. So cheapening out on reliable facts that base your knowledge is probably the dumbest thing you could do as a corporation or as a media house or whatever. But they tend to do that, from what I can see, because they think it is okay and good enough, which we know it isn't.
Mm.
Looking at the UK as well, when they completely... UK is complicated, for those who don't know. UK is a complicated and very expensive country to do political polling in, because of the majority vote in every region. And how many is it? It's
650.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
650 constituencies.
Yeah, so if you really want to do it, okay, you need at least a couple of hundred interviews in every region, 650. Which
you can't do online, which means you've got to do on telephone.
Even if you do it online, it's still so many interviews.
I remember... because it was a year I did my final exams for my degree. 1992 was the one political polling failure in the UK.
Yeah.
So basically, the other main pollsters at the time, Morrie, Harris, might have been ICM, I can't remember, had Labour. Their final poll was Labour will win.
Yeah.
Now, Gallup International had the Conservatives winning, but by half a point.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. But obviously, the Conservatives did win in '92, yeah. and it confounded the polls.
Yeah.
You know, there was an inquiry. You know, and with all these polling inquiries, it's like, you know, the sampling wasn't spot on, and there was a spiral of silence and all this kind of stuff. But now, I mean, it seems to be happening more and more and more regularly.
Yeah.
And not just in the UK. Yeah. I mean, globally.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you look at the chart of polling failures, you know, for 30 years it's gone like that. It's just gone like that.
Yeah, yeah, and that's because everyone now is shipping out on the samples, because you're going online with non-probability based panels, so it doesn't work. But it doesn't matter anymore, because what I see is that you as a research company use the excuse of a bad paying media house. You cannot afford to do it, but the problem
but
there.
You get sucked in. You do get sucked in.
All PR is good PR, so you just get our brand out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's bad.
Yeah, but one thing, because that is also a UK. I use that as an example when I do a lot of my talks is the Brexit referendum, where I think it was Ipsos said it would be Remain with a 75 or something percent probability. They released that the day before the poll. And the thing, what's happening then, which you could also see in the voter turnout, that the voting regions where Remain would be strongest, because it was a socioeconomic referendum in many senses, the voter turnout was lower there, but Leave was higher. And so many examples when you say something would happen, they use our polls. We're not saying it often, except Ipsos did that. But we basically say this is now. The election is tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing. I mean, they got sucked into that. Another friend of mine did exactly the same, and he actually did a face to face poll as well, a big face to face poll.
Yeah,
And he wrote to all the members of Parliament and all the members of the House of Lords and basically said, it will be Remain. It'll be 60-40 Remain. That's the cardinal mistake. When I was taught about polling, you know, and I guess maybe reading books or listening to my dad as a kid, you know, you were always told you don't predict. It's a snapshot in time or something. Yeah. You know, the last 2 days, whenever the field work was. These people started to predict. They started to play God with the data. Yeah. And then the amount of waiting and the manipulation of the data based off, I don't think that looks right. You know, I'm going to try and increase this education band to get Remain a little bit higher. It's terrible. We in the UK, we set up in 2000 and I want to say six or something, seven, the British Polling Council. So all which you don't have to be a member of.
Yeah.
But it happens that I think all of the pollsters are members of. And it's been very good because the rules of the British Polling Council are if you or I release or a newspaper releases a poll that you or I have done, we have to publish within, I think it's 48 hours, the full tables.
Yeah.
Mm. Right? Which basically means anyone can go on and actually look at the question wording. And you have to publish the methodology as well.
Yeah.
So, listen, I'm not saying that Joe Bloggs in the street will go and look at the numbers or the questions wording, but there are people that do that.
Yeah.
So that transparency, that rule that all the pollsters have to do that, does help. But then again, you know, I mean, a lot of journalists don't read.
Yeah.
They want a quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Just give us the numbers. Yeah. Give us the numbers, you know?
Yeah.
Don't.
Yeah.
You know, the lesson in the textbook is your data is only as good as the sample which is drawn.
Exactly. And that detail has gone lost.
No one ever says, you know, so I always say to the young people in our team when we get new data or when they're reviewing data or, you know, secondary data or whatever. They start looking at it, you know, saying, oh, 60% think this and 52% think that. I'll say, hold on a minute, tell me about the sample first of all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you do want to get your head into the actual data.
Yeah.
But you need to be disciplined enough to actually read the sample before you even contemplate reading the data findings.
And I realized during COVID, because there were data everywhere, most of the data were flawed in some sense because nobody knew anything. You just got the data you wanted and you didn't realize how... That was not our research. I mean, public statistics that were being pumped out every second. Mm. But I realized then that one of our skills as a researcher is to validate data.
Yeah.
Because we know where the pitfalls are, where you could actually go wrong. But we aren't really perceived to have that role in the public space. And I think that is a challenge because also look at inflation. What's the error margin of inflation number? I think it's a couple of percentage points.
Yeah.
But then the entire global market reacts on 0.2% inflation change.
Yeah. I remember in the so we were doing a lot of work. We still do a lot of work with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So they're it's all about vaccine confidence.
Yeah.
So with our Gallup International partner in Pakistan. We started this in 2015. Anyway, during COVID, you know, I'd watch the news and the predicted range of deaths, right, from COVID, there were different academics, epidemiologists or whatever, who were modelling predicted deaths, right? And at the lowest end, it was going to be 100,000.
Yeah.
And at the highest end, it was going to be 500,000, literally, or more, right? And there are a lot of numbers in between.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, my God, like, as a pollster, if you're 3 points out, you're toast.
Yeah.
You're finished.
Yeah.
Right? And then you got one academic group saying there's going to be 100,000 deaths, and another saying there's been 500,000 deaths.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I actually, because during the pandemic in Sweden, the government didn't have any chance to test anyone. They only tested the ones who were so sick they had to have emergency treatment. Mm-hmm. That's the only one who got tested for COVID. But that ended up showing that the mortality rate in Sweden was 8%. Because nobody knew that the data was that flaw, the testing strategy. But then I literally thought that this was end of the world as we knew it, because how it looked. So we started the day after the pandemic. We had our first research of how many were sick in Sweden, and it worked so good. It surprises me. Every data point we could look at afterwards was within the margin of error. But looking at the mortality rate, it was 0.8%. That's quite a difference, because we could check the entire population and see what symptoms they had, how sick they are, if they contacted the medical help at all, because you were told not to do it unless you were basically dying. But that was looking at the difference then, and looking at Sweden from a global perspective, seeing the mortality rate at 8%,
mm.
and then project it into, oh my God, if you get this, the world will end. Mm. When it's 0.8, that's also a disaster, but it's not even. So our role is, which I realize, as you said, we can do everything. We can do things in a way people don't understand, and we can do it quickly. And also the COVID, because I looked at the big tech companies, Facebook, Google, they were bragging when we had a flu season like 10 years ago, saying they could see the progress of the flu in US. They were quiet for 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
We could start the same day. That is.
Yeah, huge, you're right. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Because Facebook were going to, I remember being at a conference. It might even have been a Gallup International conference.
Yeah.
Like 6-7 years ago. And they were talking about threats to the industry.
Yeah.
You know, it was like Facebook.
Yeah.
or Amazon, I can't remember. We're all going to be dead, you know.
Yeah.
They're going to take away all our business. They haven't.
No. And during the pandemic, their problem, because they use our industry's methods to tweak their data. So they know how to, they waited on research once in a while. But what happens when the digital behavior changes from one day to another because of laws? All their basic tweaking of how to interpret their data based on actual behavior, it gets thrown out of the window. And how many times did the laws actually change our behaviors during a pandemic?
Oh, yeah. And that's before you've even considered the manipulation
of
the digital space.
Yeah.
Because it's true that there were people who were spreading fake news, whatever you want to call it, manipulating.
Yeah, you're right.
A lot during the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
you're right.
So, you know, Facebook, I remember that story about predicting flu or following flu around America, as you said. And that's one method. That's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah.
But there are multiple ways to look at it, and we definitely have one of those ways. As you said previously, we just probably need to be a little bit more confident.
Yeah, and if we remove the weak spot in removing a good sample, I mean, because if you have an access panel or a non-probability base where everyone can join, it's wide open to manipulation. For maybe not for the individual, but for a state, it's an easy job to dominate a panel and pushing out with the AI the message. And I've seen these examples in several spaces. Net neutrality in US, there was a referendum about that. Quite a lot of money for the internet operators in US. And the referendum, you could go online, but you had to put in your social security number, but you could go online and say what you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was no to neutrality.
Hmm.
I know Pew Research had to do dig into this because they realized people's social security numbers and names were faked. So they took people's identity just to get the referendum to go through.
Mm.
Because it was billions of dollars worth. Mm. Imagine if you could limit Netflix to only be to your internet provider. Mm. And that was a complicated thing to do. And that was like 10 years ago, I think.
Mm.
But Pew Research could see that it was a massive fraud.
Mm.
Because you have this open door. But if we as a research company randomly select individuals, the only fraud you can do is for one person.
Mm.
Because we know these people exist.
Yeah.
So and that is often forgotten and very naive to think that you wouldn't, looking at the US election and looking at how it gains another government, to push it a little bit in the direction you want. You only had to get the ball rolling basically, because then you get the help from media that likes the scandal.
Mm.
And they often use our data as one starting point. We have a huge power, but we're not really respecting that and taking responsibility.
No, we're not always on the front foot. You're right. Yeah. And maybe that's a product of, as I said, traditionally within the marketing industry.
Yeah.
I think we are. Oh, let's do advertising. Let's do this up. Yeah. Oh, and we better do some research.
Yeah. And the thing is, I talked to a CEO for a PR firm in Sweden not long ago, and because there is like this false thing that you cannot build a brand anymore. Yeah, but that has to do with them. They doing their own research, and they, because we're too expensive, so let's just get some numbers.
Mm.
But suddenly the numbers don't match up with the campaign they're doing. They cannot see any cause and effect anymore, which means that it looks like you cannot build a brand.
Mm.
So they're actually, because they want to sheep out on understanding, because they think they're so creative and whatever, and they know everything. But the campaigns that people spend millions of dollars on, you cannot see the effect. Then why spend millions of dollars?
Absolutely.
So they have been shipping out, and that is their fault, but it's also our fault, because we have played the game with them, trying to lower. I was in an SMR conference that everyone was saying that the customer can afford it, but hang on. Look at the billions or trillions of dollars that companies are spending on marketing during the world. Of course, they have money.
Yeah. But I think maybe we are too. We are at the lowest spend. I mean, yeah. You're right. The advertising. So in the sort of. So I mean, this is published, but there is a. It's called a task order, but it's basically a influence operations 5-year contract.
Yeah.
It's for the US Department of Defense. The contract ceiling doesn't mean to say that money will all be spent, but the ceiling on the contract, just for the Defense Department to put some messages in certain environments, is $990 million. Right, so $1 billion, just shy of $1 billion, right?
Yeah,
within that $1 billion, it is understandably, but it is the products and the dissemination, that will take the overwhelming majority, of that budget.
Yeah,
research will be in there because if the government's going to spend $950 million on communications, they better do a little bit of research to see whether or not it's had the effect.
Yeah.
Whereas we have been sort of pushed down to the bottom, certainly price wise.
Yeah.
And we are too frightened to, and people don't understand sampling.
Yeah.
They rushed to the data. I was trying to find, I still don't know exactly who said there's lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics.
Yeah.
Mark Twain was, I thought it was, but I read recently that it was 1895.
Yeah.
in New York University or something, I can't remember. But it is true.
Yeah,
there,
it is.
There are lies, yeah. There are damn lies. There's three types of lies. Oh, lies, yeah, that's damn right. Lies, yeah. And statistics.
Yeah, and that is true, but our job isn't to provide statistics. That's what I'm trying to push. We are validating and analyzing the facts that we get, but all facts, all statistics aren't even facts. But our job is to explain the statistics.
Yeah.
And the data and the facts that we use.
Yeah.
And everything isn't relevant, but you could build your own story using statistics. But our job is not to build the stories, to explain what the statistics means. I think that is a big differentiator we have to be stronger on as well.
Yeah. I don't disagree. Yeah. I think you're right. Interesting times, though.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I think you should definitely talk to the guy in Iraq. He's got a good story.
Yeah.